This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank God it's Friday, and thank God it is the Heritage Radio Network Week in Review. What up? This is Jack Inslee. I'm joined by the one and only Aaron Fairbanks, Executive Director of Heritage Radio Network, the world's coolest food radio station, in my humble opinion.
Is that like a reminder to get the AC in here fixed?
Oh, wow.
Jack has found God today.
Wow, I wasn't even thinking about that. How you doing, Aaron?
I am doing great. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and I am contemplating how I can work outside and or work fast enough
to leave early. Aaron, one thing you should learn about Aaron is that if she can take a meeting outside, she will do everything she can to make that possible.
I got
to
get that vitamin D.
Yeah, absolutely. It's finally like spring.
Yeah.
Kind of.
It's really happening.
Yeah, we had like a, 2 week stretch of just overcast I don't know. I'd call it like London weather.
I can't complain because my mom kept sending me pictures of snow in northern Michigan. So,
whoa,
yeah.
Okay.
She's like, yo, May, what up?
Okay. Well, then. Well, if this is your first time tuning in and you're wondering what this is all for, this is a program where we recap the week in programming at Heritage Radio Network. We do over 32 live weekly shows, so that's a lot to listen to, a lot to keep up on. We're here to distill that for you in a little week in review, as we said. And what we like to do on this program is kick it off with our last great bite. And Aaron, I've been letting you kick it off. I'm going to let you kick it off again.
Well, speaking of spring, I got to give a shout out for my spirit vegetable, asparagus. In the farmer's market, it's definitely one of those like feast or famine vegetables for me. When it's in season, I buy and eat as much as possible, which is exactly what I've been doing for the last week. In all different forms, roasted, sauteed, raw, chopped into salads, straight up. I feel like asparagus is like the reminder we're heading into, you know, here in the Northeast, into the major kind of growing season. So it just feels like getting ready to binge on all the great vegetables when they're at their peak. So shout out to asparagus.
Shout out to asparagus. I am going to shout out a really, really, really awesome restaurant. If you took like the mind of Jack and materialized it into a restaurant, you'd probably end up with Maketo, which is not only like Taiwanese, Thai, all kinds of Southeast Asian influenced food, but they have like a sneaker shop in the front. Like when you're waiting for your table, there's just like streetwear and sneakers. It's pretty ridiculous. This place is in Washington, D.C. A good friend of ours, Eric Bruner Yang, really cool chef, really cool dude, Maketo Restaurant. I was in D.C. over the weekend and had a really incredible meal and an incredible time shopping for sneakers. So, like, it all works out. I had, let's see what we had. We had the Taiwanese fried oyster, which was insane. And then I had the spicy lob over bone marrow, which was also insane. Some of the best bone marrow I ever had. Just, oh, you feel so good. Well, I feel so good after eating something
really?
Like that.
Yeah, I feel like I get bone marrow, but it never is like as good as it sounds when I like read about it in like a Jim Harrison novel. Like
this felt right. You know, this felt right. I had like a tall boy tiger beer, some bone marrow. Yeah, it was my happy place. So out to Maketo, out to Eric Bruner Yang. A lot of exciting things on the horizon with him. And if you're ever in the D.C. area, that is where you want to be.
Nice, nice. Well, get there, folks. D.C., nation's capital.
Do
we
it.
Salute you.
And with that, Aaron, let's listen to some clips from this week at Heritage Radio Network. Oh, yeah. One of my favorites, one of your favorites, one of everybody's favorites, Mr. Harold McGee, was on Cooking Issues this week. For those who are listening for the first time, Cooking Issues is a show hosted by Dave Arnold. I like to say he is like the food science guy out there right now, but that would be doing a disservice to Harold McGee, who's like the OG food science guy. Really a legend.
East Coast, West Coast.
Right, exactly. Right? Actually, yeah, that works. This was the 250th episode of Cooking Issues, which we didn't really realize until midway through the show, which is pretty funny.
Typical.
Typical. So, yeah, Harold McGee joined us by phone and... answered that, you know, he and Dave had a great time, of course. And let's listen to a little bit of the insight that Harold shares on Cooking Issues this week.
Woke up one morning, made a cup of coffee, and realized I couldn't taste my coffee, or I couldn't smell it. And that was scary because I'm in the middle of writing a book about smell. And so I have a friend who was at the time the director of the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, you know, center that specializes in taste and smell. And I wrote him immediately and said, yeah, what do I do about this? And he basically said, it's a very common problem that lots and lots of people over the course of their lifetime do lose their sense of smell for a period of time, that it's happened to him, and that there's really nothing that specialists in the field can do to help or to comfort you. You know, there's just no predicting when it's going to come back and how.
I feel like Harold is like kind of legitimately king of the humble brag. It's like, you know, because I'm writing a book on smell. And so I just called, you know, my friend who's the director of, you know, Chemical Senses in Philadelphia, like you do.
Yeah, seriously. What a scary thought, though, huh?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we've all had that experience of getting sick. It's weird as I feel like when you get sick and you actually feel kind of fine, but you can't taste anything. Ugh. And really, you know, something a lot of you know, writers, food writers in particular, kind of write about and observe as you get older, like everything in your body, your taste buds, your sense of taste, your sense of smell does start to deteriorate, which I think is you know, just a really great reminder to be present and to like take that extra moment when you're sitting in front of the, you know, beautiful dish or the bone marrow, the fresh asparagus, and just really kind of savor that flavor.
Smell
savor
the roses.
That moment. Yeah. Yeah. But it's like really tied to identity too, especially if you work professionally in food. You know, I got real sick earlier this year and didn't eat for like 5 days. And I was like, who am I? I don't recognize myself.
That is creepy. I was getting sick recently and I took a bunch of Zicam, which I found is like this miracle cure for when a cold is coming on. And then
like, these statements have not been evaluated by the
exactly. I read the back of the label and it's like you may lose your sense of taste permanently from this. And I was like, what? And then I did some research on the internet and there were a few lawsuits of people who lost their sense of taste permanently. So
abort.
Yeah, abort. Exactly.
Abort.
No more Zicam.
It doesn't sound like something you should be eating anyway. I feel like if the name sounds like it could be like potentially taking down Superman, avoid it.
It did crush my cold, but you know, I digress. Let's move on to something a little less scary. Tea, Japanese tea. Aaron, I know you're way into this. So Akiko Katayama is the host of Japan Eats, and she hosted a wonderful program and talked to Zach, the owner of the tea company Kettle, and he talked about soba cha, which let's listen to them first and see what they had to say.
In terms of Japanese tea, we have a pretty wide variety.
Right. Well, buckwheat tea, people don't know much about it, but it's like a very distinctive flavor.
Yeah.
And I think it's refreshing and doesn't have much caffeine.
Zero, yeah, right? Zero caffeine. It's actually become it's the number two best-selling product we have. And one of the things about it that's kind of fascinating to me is when people drink it, it's not a flavor that they're maybe have had any experience with, but they feel a sense of connection to it. Like a lot of people say it's very comforting. Like, and I had that experience when I drank it. I'd never had really soba cha before, but immediately it was like an instinct, like, oh, this feels similar. Like, I feel like I've had this before, but maybe it tastes like a food. A lot of people that grew up having like kasha, that type of cooked grain, they have some connection to it that way.
And but, something like I wouldn't say like a mint, but it's something refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I never succeeded in how to describe it because it's such a
unique
flavor.
Yeah, it's toasty, nutty, a little bit. It's very aromatic, I think, but it's very.
I'm like, did she toss in game meat as a potential descriptor of the tea there? I'm like, Akiko, I think you may have lost me on that. But you brought it back. You brought it back. It's because it's a new flavor. It's toasty. It's exciting. And I feel like that's the thing I like love about Japan Eats is it really is like this weekly reminder of how shallowly we like generally have delved into all the amazing kind of like food and bev culture in Japan. And I feel like I just learned something new every week and I have like this running list of like, gotta try this, gotta go there. She is like such a finger on the pulse.
It's funny because I've never tried it and I'm sitting here trying to imagine what it would taste like. That like comforting, I don't know.
Well, like savory tea, I feel like is not a super familiar concept to the American palate, but it is something, you know, we drink coffee, and if you don't add sugar to it, that has a lot of those like same kind of toasty, warm, and occasionally like vegetal flavors to it. But yeah, always room for more fancy beverages in our life.
Absolutely. And always room for cheese in our lives as we transition to the last clip here. Our flagship cheese show, the only cheese show, the best cheese show I know of, Cutting the Curd, celebrated episode 264 this week. And they had Ann Saxelby on the program. Ann Saxelby, of course, the proprietor of Saxelby Cheese and Cheesemongers, and she was the original host of Cutting the Curd way back when, 2009 or 2010. She has not been hosting the show for the past few years. Greg Blaze, the cheesemonger over at Eataly, has taken over alongside Emily Acosta, who's also a cheesemonger at Eataly. And they had Ann Saxelby back on the show to kind of talk about the origins of Cutting the Curd and how she got involved. So this was a really special treat. And we always love having Ann on the network. And here's a little clip.
And I was like, why the hell am I coming out here? I was like, I'm so busy. I definitely can't do this. But then I was like, and where the hell am I? Because at that time, I mean,
sure.
Yeah, Bushwick, I mean, it's still very industrial, but like even more so back then.
Yeah.
So
you could actually get hurt around here.
Yeah. 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 Totally. So we pulled up and I was just like, where are we going? What is this place? And we come in and we do the show and it was really fun. And of course, like I got not grumpy like immediately. And I was like, this is so weird and cool. I love it. And, Patrick, just like happened to be coming by that day. And he was like, oh, he's like, well, you know, we really want to have a cheese show on the radio network. And I was like, yeah, right. Like thinking to myself, like, like I definitely don't have time for that. And like, I'm an overcommitter and no way.
Not you.
But then what I said, of course, was sure. Yeah. Let's go out for a beer and talk about it. And you know, so there I was, I wound up with a radio show and a husband, you know,
nice.
And now two kids. So,
sweet.
You know,
sweet.
Yeah.
Listen, we can't guarantee, every potential radio host will be delivered a husband and two children, but we do our best here at the radio network to provide you with life-changing experiences.
Ain't that the truth? I will never forget those days. Patrick definitely, I like how she's like, he just happened to be there. There was
a little bit of strategy involved.
There was some strategy. And for the first like five or so episodes of Cutting the Curd, Patrick would always come in and be like, because, you know, Anne's from the Midwest and she's, you know, she's from a real sports family. And he'd come and be like, all right, what sports theme song can you find that we can surprise Anne with this week? So like it would be the Olympics theme music or like the Monday Night Football theme song. And every week he would have me pull up a song and surprise Anne, and he'd kind of like stay in the back control room here to watch and see what her reaction was. And I remember those days fondly. It's pretty incredible to think that they're married with two kids now.
I feel like wooing tips that you can get also via Love Bites Radio, another great show on love,
nice
sex, and dating.
Look at that.
But also, yeah, once you get that like lovely lady, also some wonderful like cheese coursing and cheese selection via Cutting the Curd, but also just a real peek in this episode in particular into a pretty important part of New York City history, especially looking at the Lower East Side and how the city interacts with entrepreneurs and small businesses. And when you hear terms like kind of gentrification and development, you know, what that means, what that looks like, and who has a voice in that conversation. I mean, there, I know we're talking about some of the lighter aspects of the episode, but there's real political stuff going on at the Essex Market, and it's great to see Anne taking such a leadership role there and being a real role model for people in that space.
Yeah, one more Saxelby shout out. Of course, the Saxelby Scholars Program, supported by her parents. So there's a lot of Saxelby love here at the Heritage Radio Network.
We're beaming.
Alrighty. Well, we're going to get boozy here in just a second. And with that, let's move into the breakdown.
It is 10:17 on the, you know, radio clock. So let's talk mezcal. Seems
perfect
pretty
perfect time for mezcal.
Perfect time for mezcal. I think one of the things I'm excited about is learning about all the times, the mezcal times. So we are joined on the line by Susan Koss of Mezcalistas to talk about a very exciting event that's happening here in the city later this week and to learn a little bit more about mezcal in general. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I want to start with like the kind of fast and dirty description of like what mezcal is for anyone who's kind of had their head in the sand for the last couple of years.
Yes, well, it has become the topic of conversation in the distillate spirits world. Mezcal is an agave distillate in the same family as tequila, and it's produced in the country of Mexico. And it is a huge cultural beverage that has been produced for the last 500 years, and actually there have been indications that it has been distilled pre-Spanish, which is very exciting that you've got these academics. But it's a lovely beverage where they take the agave plant or a maguey, cut the leaves off, roast the heart of the agave with hot coals, cover it, which is how it gets this kind of a roasty flavor, and then crush it, ferment it, and distill it from there. It's a pretty simple process. And the mezcal is very much like a wine story with the influence of terroir, land, water. The mezcalero or the mezcal maker himself or herself, the flavors that they bring out of it. And it's really exciting to see this beverage just get its time in the limelight now.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm always excited in, pursuing new drinking opportunities. That being said, like, is there a kind of go-to traditional way of drinking mezcal? And kind of on the flip side of that, what are some of the new kind of beverage spaces that are opening up as people are learning more about it?
Right. Well, mezcal is traditionally sipped out of jicaras, which are dried squash gourds. There's huge arguments of, oh, you should never drink out of that. You should only drink out of glass or little clay copitas that you see sometimes in bars. But usually it's during celebrations, and they could be weddings, baptisms, Christmas posadas, the big festivals and calendas that you see in the streets if you're down in southern Mexico. And sometimes you pass the bottle around. But it's not really shot like we do have been taught to do tequila here. It's, it's a slow sip, small sips. You can drink it all night and long. And probably the greatest benefit of mezcal is that there's no hangover. And that's because I'll put it out there. There's no hangover. And that is because there are no additives in a traditionally made mezcal. There's no added sugars. There's no added yeast. There's no added chemicals, nothing. It is just pure agave, water, and then the fermentation that pulls out the sugars. So.
So Via Mezcalistas, you guys have been putting on a big event on the West Coast, Mezcal in Mexico in a bottle, and you're bringing that to New York this year. So for folks who haven't, like myself, who haven't been able to enjoy the West Coast version, give us a little bit of a taste of what we can expect coming up June 5th and 6th here in New York City.
Yes, the event's going to be held at Casa Mezcal, which is very fitting in the Lower East Side. And the idea of the event is to present Mezcal within more of a cultural context. So it's not just this straight up, you know, come and drink a lot of alcohol event. We incorporate aspects of music, of talks about different parts of mezcal and themes, be it the flavors that bartenders are drawn to or that chefs are drawn to, sustainability issues that are happening, and then you're able to taste and eat all of this mezcal and Mexican food. So it's a lot of fun, and it's an opportunity to talk a little bit more about what makes each of these different types of mezcals unique from the other mezcals that are there, because it is a regional story. We'll have mezcals from the state of Oaxaca, from the state of Guerrero, from Durango, from San Luis Potosi, so different areas, and it gives you a chance to really explore the flavor varieties of it. And then we'll be working with some guest bartenders who will be mixing up some special cocktails, which right now is probably the way most people are introduced to mezcal, and serving them to folks to kind of get that chance to try savory cocktails or the more citrusy cocktails, and to understand that mezcal is kind of a perfect cocktail beverage because it can go in any direction because it has such interesting flavors.
I love that. I also like any opportunity to do comparative tasting, because, you know, I'm probably not going to start my exploration of mezcal at my house with like 17 right. different bottles. So having a chance for someone to kind of like narrow that scope for me. Well, curious, kind of what was your kind of mezcal awakening? I mean, how did you decide that this was the kind of spirit for you?
Well, it was a slow process. The first, I traveled to Oaxaca in 2003 for the first time, and I am first and foremost a food person, and I am drawn to food stories and the sustainability around food. And I had heard about food in Oaxaca, and I should go, and I took cooking classes, and it was there during Day of the Dead. And I tried mezcal, and I have to admit, the first time I tried it, I was like, ugh, this is, I don't really like this. I'm sure I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were at a big Day of the Dead party, and there was a bottle being passed around, and I, you know, tried some, and I was like, whoa, this is mezcal? This is delicious. And then, you know, from there, just started exploring a little bit more about mezcal. And anytime I was back down in Oaxaca, I would try something else. And it coincided with an awakening on my part here in the United States, being involved in sustainable food projects, that was reinforced every time I went to Oaxaca, to Mexico, of, wow, this is really a great story, mezcal, the production of it, how, you know, the sustainability factor of it, the complexity of it. And by about 2011 was when I was just like, you know what, I really want to do something that involves mezcal. And I found a fantastic business partner, Max Garoni, and he and I launched a blog, Mezcalistas, in 2012, and from there just started the education and tasting events, which, you know, the idea is they're educational, but they also have to be fun too, because mezcal is the embodiment of life, you know, in Mexico. And it's just like, you're having a terrible day, have a little bit of mezcal. You're having a great day,
have, you know, a little bit of mezcal. You're speaking my language here. Well, I think that is like one of the things that's so fascinating about tucking a little bit more into the spirits world, is we don't often as consumers really make the connection between our cocktail and agriculture, and how intertwined those two things really are. And, you know, we're just about out of time, but I do have a question, because I can't remember. Is agave a plant that you cultivate or that you just harvest?
It's, there's the cultivated agave, and then there are also wild agaves.
Okay.
And so it is both. And so agricultural practices are key to long-term survivability. And there are issues with the wild harvesting of the agave, as you're seeing over-harvesting, and in fact, some agave species and plants that are nearing just disappearing because they've been over-harvested. So it's, you know, there's huge issues to talk about when it comes to mezcal production. And I think it's one of those spirits that it lifts the lid on being able to talk about the agricultural story when it comes to alcohol, just as you were saying, which we just, you know, we rarely talk about. And I'm hoping it, like, leads us to be able to have those conversations about rum production and, you know, then about whiskey production and particularly corn whiskey, and the opportunity to talk about organic corn and GMOs and all of that. So it's, you know, I think that this is a great gateway spirit that could change a lot of our perceptions of what we ask for when we're drinking spirits.
Oh, man, I cannot wait. Susan, if folks want to come check out the event or if they want to learn more about you and your work, where should we send them?
Well, they can check our blog, which is mezcalistas.com. And then we also have an event page set up for Mexico in a Bottle, and that is mexinabottle.com.
Awesome. That's June 5th and 6th, guys. Mark your calendars. It's going to be at Casa Mezcal on the Lower East Side. Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I look forward to cheersing over some mezcal soon.
Yes, I look forward to it, too. Thank you again.
Wow, yeah, I need some mezcal now, like, immediately. The
breakfast mezcal.
That was awesome. That was a great way to kick off the weekend, some mezcal facts. And let's close the show here with some big ups. All right. Like I mentioned, this is Big Ups. This is where we like to send some love over to some people or some establishments or some organizations that we just love. And I'm gonna kick this one off, Aaron. I'm gonna big ups Patrick Martins for really shepherding in this news show on the Heritage Radio Network. You know, it's every time Patrick has an idea, he's very excited about it, including the idea to start Heritage Radio Network. And you're like, it's going to be food radio. It's going to be the, and then all of a sudden you blink your eyes and it's just happening. And I believe we hosted the fourth or fifth episode of the Heritage Radio News Show this week. And it's really kind of like getting into a groove here. And I'm really proud of the work of everybody on that program. I, of course, this is a little bit of a shameless plug. I'm the sports reporter on the show.
full disclosure.
Yeah, full disclosure. I do the sports. But it has really, really been fun and great. And I encourage listeners, check it out. The last episode was a lot of fun. It's the Heritage Radio Network News with news, music, and everything.
Nice.
That's my big ups.
Nice. I support your big ups. Definitely check out the news program. Super fun. I'm going in a slightly different direction. This is probably not a guy who needs a lot of big ups because I think at last count he was like the 15th most wealthy person in the world.
Wow, 15.
Yeah. Net value of $26.2 billion. We are talking about, of course, Phil Knight, the founder of Nike. I have been enjoying his recently released memoir, Shoe Dog, which is basically the story of the founding of Nike. And it is great so far. I'm about halfway through. And there's something incredibly inspiring and fascinating about hearing the genesis story of what is now a behemoth, you know, international brand. And to think about, you know, the student graphic designer who stopped by the early offices and designed the swoosh for, guess how much?
I don't know.
$35.
What?
Yep. Which was like a totally decent and fair kind of salary and space and place for where the organization was at the time. You know, you talk about Phil literally driving around the country, selling shoes out of the back of his car.
I want to see what those shoes looked like.
Yeah, transitioning into, you know, talking about Prefontaine and really the rise of athletes being sponsored to wear shoes and so many things that are seem ubiquitous, seem like they've always been there in the pop culture and the like kind of style of today that you know, really came from a guy with like a lot of gumption and risk taking. And it's interesting to hear about, you know, the company being 6, 7, 8, you know, years old and things being really just at the margins, really, you know, stressful, really looking for capital, really looking for customers. And it's a great book and I'm really enjoying it. So I recommend it. Shoe Dog, Phil Knight.
I recommend the shoes. Nike shoes. They're good.
Jack is not a paid endorser of Nike, but no. He's totally willing to be. Phil, if you're listening.
That's right. Yeah, for real.
Send us a box.
I'll definitely take some Air Forces. Yeah, no problem. Awesome. Well, that was a really fun week in review. Aaron, thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in. And if you loved it, hated it, or anything in between, and you want to let us know, we're at Heritage_Radio on Twitter, on Instagram, Heritage Radio Network on Facebook, and lastly, info@heritageradionetwork.org to send us any messages. We would love to hear from you, and we hope you tell all your friends about this fun food recap program. And we'll see you next week with more Week in Review. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.